There is an unusual disclaimer on author Joyce Carol Oates' homepage, Celestial Timepiece. It addresses the rumor that she has been nominated or been on the shortlist for the Nobel Prize for Literature. She has not, yet, so far as anyone knows, but frankly, it's a bit of a surprise. Her list of awards and honors runs some 6 pages, and it would be impossible to list the works of this prolific writer in this introduction. So I'll stick with her most recently published book, Wild Nights. It's a collection of short stories about the last days of Edgar Allan Poe, Emily Dickinson, Mark Twain, Henry James, and Ernest Hemingway. These are not true stories. Instead, she uses the power of her considerable imagination and her talents as a writer to invent what could be called fictional memoirs. Joyce Carol Oates is in our New York bureau. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I'd like to start with the Henry James story, simply because you always list him as an influence, and if I'm not mistaken, you keep a quotation from him on your bulletin board?
Oh, absolutely. I've been reading Henry James most of my adult life.
Yeah, the quotation I love, "We work in the dark, we do what we can, we have what we have, our doubt is our passion, and our passion is our task, the rest is the madness of art."
Yes.
How, first of all, does he inspire you as a writer? And then explain why this particular story you write about him as a hospital worker during the First World War.
Well, Henry James is a model for many writers, just his lifelong commitment to literature, his extraordinary intensity, his language, and the versatility of his writing. He volunteered to work in the hospitals during World War I. His friend Edith Wharton encouraged him to do this volunteer work. And he was just remarkable, rather like Walt Whitman with the young Civil War soldiers.
He makes comparisons to Walt Whitman during the course of the story. And you bring up an aspect of his life. You're kind of speculating why he would work in a hospital during his later days. And you're writing him saying, "I was a coward at 18. I ran away from the war." And the other thing is he was very fastidious, certainly, in his writing. And here he is among the blood and the gore and, you know, the souls of broken men.
Yes, it is amazing how we can suddenly in times of emergency be so different from our previous lives. He had been a very fussy bachelor, extremely difficult, I'm sure, to deal with. And then when he found himself among people who needed him, and young men, so some of them very badly maimed and dying and injured, and in a context of terrible smells and terrible sights, he sort of threw off that fastidious manner, and he rose to the occasion. He was just very, very human. He read the newspaper and some poetry to the soldiers, but he didn't try to read his own writing because he knew it would not be appropriate.
Huh. You talk about being human. It's curious because the last days of Emily Dickinson, you imagine her as a robot.
Yes. Yes, I was trying to think of a metaphor for how we bring art and music and poetry into our lives. People have libraries at home, they have bookshelves, they have CDs, and they sort of people try to bring great artists into their lives, into their physical houses, and sort of live with portions of them, but they're not really deeply engaging with them. So I took it a step farther where people could have little mannequins of great people like Sigmund Freud, or it could be Babe Ruth, or it could be Abraham Lincoln, in this case it's Emily Dickinson, and have this person come and live in your house. Of course, it's a computer program that's been put into a mannequin and can respond in ways that seem lifelike.
It's interesting. She seems more flesh and blood as a robot. I mean, we always read about her, you know, secluded in her room and so forth. But in this one, I get the sense that even as a mechanical, she kind of longs to break free.
Well, she was not secluded in her room. She was in the house. Basically, she was like a housewife. What she didn't do was, after the age of about 20, she didn't travel.
Maybe it's not her being so much flesh and blood, but the way that the two people that buy her treat her, they keep forgetting that she's a replicant.
Yes, and you would, because she's so, I think Emily Dickinson's poetry is just so brilliant and so enigmatic. There are poets among them, my friends, I mean, major American poets who think that Emily Dickinson might be among the very, very best poets who ever lived, you know, right up there with Shakespeare. And I tend to agree. The language, the thinking, the subtlety, the astonishing intensity of her poetry, you can read it over and over again and get so many, you yield so many meanings. So if you had a replica of Emily Dickinson in your house, it would be like having a riddle around you all the time. It would make you a yearning to be a little more sharp yourself, which is what the characters in the story try to do.
The title Wild Nights comes from one of Emily Dickinson's poems.
Yes, Wild Nights. If you were with me, Wild Nights would be our luxury.
The Hemingway story, this one seems closest to the truth. I mean, you get a sense of a man who seems to have given up on himself.
Most people who are writers go through periods when they can't write. With Hemingway, it was at a time in his life when he was very depressed. He was physically ill. He drank an extraordinary amount. He burnt himself out. So he couldn't write anymore, and he finally commits suicide in the way that his own father did decades before.
You talk about how he wasn't the nicest man, and at one point he mishears something. I guess he received an accolade for being the greatest writer of his generation.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And he hears it as the greatest hater of his generation.
Yes, I'm afraid that's so. I don't know why he was like that.
Yeah, but in your story, I mean, I almost get a sense that he had a terrible self-loathing as well, which is probably where this anger and meanness came from.
Yes, it had a lot to do with his family background. His mother was a very dominant, very overbearing woman, extremely pushy. When Hemingway was a really little boy, like 2, 3 years old, the mother dressed him in girl's clothing, and he had long hair. She wanted him to look like the twin of her daughter. So he left home, and he went away, and basically never came back. When he was about 18, he left home. I think he had to do that.
Other than the fact that you're chronicling with this sort of prose fiction the last days of these great writers, is there another thread that holds these stories together?
Well, that's a good question. I guess I'm always looking for models, as we all are, like certain ways of life. And Edgar Allan Poe, the Gothic romantic way in which the physical is ignored doesn't seem to be a viable alternative. In Emily Dickinson, though, I felt that she was a very good model, even though she led a very cloistered life. She wrote her poetry. She wrote 776 poems, many of which are extraordinary quality, so she left that body of work behind. Mark Twain was very unhappy with himself. For various reasons, he was very unhappy with America of his time. He thought it was terrible that we had no anti-lynching laws. And he was also a feminist, and he was also very concerned with anti-Semitism. He was a good man, but he was hard on himself. And Henry James, I thought, became heroic. I just so admired him at the end of his life. And Hemingway, of course, was a tragedy. But for those of us who know about alcoholism, we can probably say that alcoholism is an illness. Once he became ill with alcoholism, he couldn't give up drinking, and so he lost his soul.
I'm going to ask a personal question. Your husband of a long time, 40 years, passed away this year. How are you coping?
Well, since my husband passed away, I'm not working nearly as much. I think I have about a 40% efficiency. I don't know if we've ever suffered any trauma or loss, but you just get very, very tired. Sure. Just don't have the energy anymore. Maybe it will come back somehow, but it's a different life. I feel like a different person.
Joyce Carol Oates, her recently published collection is called Wild Nights, Stories About the Last Days of Poe, Dickinson, Twain, James, and Hemingway. She joined us from our New York bureau. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you so much.
A lot of fiction has arisen from the tale of a young man or woman coming of age. Two variations on this motif recently arrived in bookstores. One comes from debut novelist Susan Gregg Gilmore, the other from Texas writer Dagoberto Gilb. Here's our reviewer, Alan Shoes.
Break from your parents. Discover that the past was different than you thought it was. Put your hometown in the rearview mirror. It's an old story, but a couple of new novels based on this theme stand out, mostly for good reasons. First, Susan Gregg Gilmore's light-as-air fiction titled Looking for Salvation at the Dairy Queen. This Georgia story starts so light, I almost had to twist my own arm to keep reading. Our narrator comes in the form of a motherless preacher's daughter. Catherine Grace Klein has a dutiful Baptist boyfriend and a lot of illusions. More than anything, she wants to leave tiny Ringgold, Georgia. It's a little too quiet for her there. They do nothing much except go to church and grow tomatoes in Ringgold. Catherine Grace's biggest thrill is walking to the Dairy Queen for a dilly bar, and she wants to quit town so bad she'd almost just curse or tear up her recipe for strawberry jam. We do learn all about making the jam, but even after Catherine Grace succeeds in escaping from Ringgold and landing a job in Atlanta, the book still reads like meringue when you really want pie. Darn, as our heroine might say, I'm glad I kept going. Because before it ends, the preacher's daughter makes a sad return home. All of those illusions fall away, revealing everyone from Daddy to her old boyfriend in a different light. And that recipe? Well, this story's author's got it almost just right. The main character in our second novel couldn't be more different. The Flowers by Dagoberto Gilb centers on a teenage Chicano boy named Sonny Bravo. He's living with his mother and her new gringo contractor husband somewhere out west, in a sweltering two-bedroom apartment in a building called The Flowers, of course. And what's in the name? A lot of folks who don't smell so sweet. We meet a racist construction worker, a dodgy car salesman, the lusty wife of a drug dealer, and a young girl caring for her infant brother who declares that sometimes she hates being Mexican. Sonny takes to stealing money and fooling around with the dealer's wife, but deep down, he really wants the girl. She was so chula, he says. Her eyes, the whites of them, the black of them, her eyelashes, her eyebrows, her nose, her cheeks, her lips, her chin, her neck, each strand of her hair in place as alive as the ones that floated in the breeze while I stood at the open door, wishing I knew how to make her kiss. Along with Sonny's daydreams come lessons about life fast and hard, his adolescence becoming haunted by violence at home and outside on the streets. The age to which this boy comes is quite different than what you find in Ringgold, Georgia. No tomatoes, no ice cream, certainly no pie, just the rip and run of city life, and yet through it all, the taste of something sweet, a faint hope of love in the offing, even as sirens scream out above an angry city.
The novels are Looking for Salvation at the Dairy Queen by Susan Gregg Gilmore and The Flowers by Dagoberto Gilb. Alan Shoes teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
Writer Ursula Le Guin has long been known for inventing fantastic worlds. She's published 20 novels, many of them science fiction, and whether her stories are set far into the future or in a mythical past, she often draws on legend, anthropology, and history. My colleague Jackie Lydon spoke with Ursula Le Guin about her new novel, Lavinia. Le Guin picks a bit player out of Virgil's epic poem, The Aeneid, and builds that character's story into its own epic. Here's Jackie.
Let's begin with Lavinia's story. Would you please read a little bit where we meet her, where we meet this woman with a very impassioned and distinctive voice?
Sure. I won't die. Of that I'm all but certain. My life is too contingent to lead to anything so absolute as death. I haven't enough real mortality. No doubt I'll eventually fade away and be lost in oblivion, as I would have done long ago if the poet hadn't summoned me into existence. Like Spartan Helen, I caused a war. She caused hers by letting men who wanted her take her. I caused mine because I wouldn't be given, wouldn't be taken, but chose my man and my fate. The man was famous, the fate obscure. Not a bad balance.
Now that really makes me want to get to know this character that you basically did not invent, but you invented her life. Why did she speak to you so forcefully?
Virgil's Lavinia is a kind of like a stock figure. In the last six books of the Aeneid, he's doing war. He's not doing love anymore. And she is kind of the stark maiden who has to marry the hero. And that's all he had time for, in a sense, with her. And yet, knowing how well Virgil understood women and the respect that he had for them, I felt that it was not taking any liberties with Virgil for me to imagine who Lavinia really was and what she was like and what her life was like.
Mm-hmm. When we meet her, she's about 19 years old, and that's the time in which she's going to become a wife. She has many suitors, and Lavinia hates having all these suitors.
She simply is not in love with any of these guys and is not particularly attracted by them. She isn't ready yet.
She is a feminist heroine. She has a quiet voice, but a very assertive one.
But, you know, this book was not written like Margaret Atwood's Penelope book to sort of right a wrong or set Homer straight. You don't need to set Virgil straight on women. I mean, look at Dido. Everybody knows Dido, for goodness sakes. She's much more famous than Aeneas, really. But Lavinia was my way into Virgil's world. And his discourse about power and about war. Because what Virgil is talking about in those last six books, I think partly is what makes a real hero and what is the moral cost even of heroic victory? And that seemed a really relevant question to me.
Was there anything conscious as you were writing in which the war that grinds on and on and on here in this book, does it have any resonance for us, a culture, having been at war for the last 5 years?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's one reason why these last six books of the epic hit me so hard. He's talking about a war that you really can't stop fighting.
Now, you read the Aeneid to prepare for this, and my understanding is that you yourself read it in Latin rather than using any of the translations that are available.
Well, I was actually teaching myself Latin to read Virgil, which is what I always wanted to read in Latin. And so I finally, in my 70s, I thought, you know, you better do it now or you won't have time. So I sort of dug into the Latin again and got to where I could read Virgil very slowly. I mean, 10 lines a day is good for me. But the fact is, he is a very great poet, and he's the kind of poet who doesn't really translate very well. The poetry just gets lost.
Would you like to try to read some of the Latin for us, Ursula Le Guin? Would you be willing to give us a little blast?
I will do it if all the Latin scholars listening will not write me angry emails afterwards.
We're going to put a little warning label on that.
Just 3 lines.
Okay.
This is Turnus pleading for mercy from Aeneas, who's wounded him and is standing over him at the very end of the book. And he says, Vicisti et victum tendere palmas ausoni videre, tua est Lavinia coniunx, ulterius ne tenda odis. And it means, you've won, the Italians saw me lift up my hands defeated, Lavinia is your wife, take your hate no farther. But Aeneas sees that he's wearing a gold belt that he stole from a Greek kid whom Aeneas was fond of, and he loses his temper and he kills him. Mm. And there the book ends. Why did he do that? Why did he show his good, patient, obedient, pious hero doing something so brutal and essentially unnecessary? Perhaps even unwise. Why did he do that? He knew what he was doing. Because this is what happens in a war, I think.
Mm-hmm. So we have to remember that when you hear Virgil read aloud in Latin and you're understanding Latin, your passions are meant to be stirred. This is an epic. What you have done is very much a meditation on war.
Yeah, but I got the idea from Virgil, from his meditation on war, too. It appears that the Aeneid was in part written as a sort of message to Augustus, who was, you know, his patron, who had just become emperor and had just kind of Well, he ended the civil wars, but at a very high cost in liberty and a few other things. And it seems to me that Virgil is fairly clearly saying, is Augustus, look out. Count the cost of empire. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the war gate gets opened purposefully, and at least on one occasion, the gate of war in this ancient kingdom is just left open and no one knows why.
Right. Right. It seems like a good metaphor to me.
Well, Ursula Le Guin, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you about your new novel, Lavinia. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jack.
Here's a story that is guaranteed to bring in just a few letters. It's about a picture book for children written by a plastic surgeon. The book is called My Beautiful Mommy. In it, a little girl narrates the story of her mother getting a tummy tuck and a nose job. We sent one of our producers out to sample some reactions from real mommies.
If you're going to do it, I think you should prep your kids. And I think, you know, using literature is a fantastic way. So I think that's great.
I just get concerned if you're reading this book to a young child, not a teenager, a young child, what impression that leaves on them about their own body and how they feel about it.
I would not read this book to my young child.
The book makes it look like this sweetsy, fun little natural part of the everyday living, and it's not. We're cutting ourselves for the sake of our looks.
Joining me now is the author of the book, My Beautiful Mommy, plastic surgeon Michael Salzhauer. Welcome to Day to Day.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you write this book?
Well, I wrote this book to fill a specific need that I saw in my own practice. I should make it clear from the outset, this is not a general children's book. This was written for patients who have already made the decision that they're going to have a tummy tuck or rhinoplasty. And these operations are not a simple surgery in the morning and lunch with the girls at noon. These operations require a lot of downtime, 2 or 3 weeks typically, and they turn your household upside down. And what I've been noticing is in my own practice is a lot of mothers bring their children to the preoperative consultations, the postoperative visits, and they really don't explain to their kids what's happening. The kids can get pretty confused. They typically associate a visit to the doctor's office with sickness and death. And when you don't give them information, they fill in the gaps with their imagination. On a personal note, I had my own nose done. I had a nose job when my oldest child was about 4 and a half. And I remember the look on her face when, I didn't tell her what was going to happen. And when I came home with the bandages and the black eyes, we had a long discussion about it.
As you heard in that sampling of moms, mm-hmm. some of the women didn't like this book at all. And one passage for them in particular stood out, where the daughter mm-hmm. asks the mom why she's going to look different. And the mom right. responds, not just different, my dear, prettier. And, right. A lot of people are wondering what kind of message this is giving young girls.
Well, that page has been taken out of context a little bit. The page before that, there's a scene where the mom and daughter are driving home from the doctor's office, and the mom says, I'm going to look a little different after the surgery. To a six-year-old girl, what does a different nose look like? And you see a thought bubble where she thinks the mom's nose is going to look like a witch's nose or a pig's nose. What do you mean different? And so the mom just replies, not just different, not like a witch's nose or a pig's nose. It's going to look prettier. And, I agonized over the verbiage a little bit. I could have said straighter, but I figured an astute 7-year-old child or 6-year-old child would say, well, why do you need your nose straighter? And that would inevitably lead to the question of prettier. And there's two ways to go about this. You can deny it or paper it over, or you can just face the issue head on. And that's sort of a jumping off point that every parent can then use to either open that discussion up further with, discussions about the value of beauty. But again, the bulk of the book is dedicated to explaining the fact that mom is going to be in bed, that she's not going to be able to pick the kids up from school. You see a picture where the dad's doing the dishes and the daughter is taking the milk, the heavy milk, out of the refrigerator because mom can't lift things for a couple of weeks. And it really shows how the child can aid mom in her recovery. And that was really the goal of the book. It wasn't meant to be read as a children's bedtime tale like Goodnight Moon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Has your wife had plastic surgery?
No, she hasn't yet. We're expecting our fifth in December, in September, rather.
Oh, congratulations.
And, thank you. And, I think she's perfect the way she is.
Well, Dr. Michael Salzhauer, thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Michael Salzhauer is a plastic surgeon in Florida. He's the author of a new children's book called My Beautiful Mommy.
more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.